Welcome to Without Prejudice, tonight being recorded from Gray's Inn in London. And I'd like to thank Gray's for providing us with the room tonight for our debate and discussion. On the panel tonight is David Alan Green, solicitor and a witness at the Leveson Inquiry. He's also the legal correspondent for the New Statesman and blogs under the name Jacob Kent. Carl Gardner is a very familiar participant in these podcasts, and he's author of the Head of Legal blog, his next government lawyer. And a special welcome to Jez Hindmarsh, who, for his sins recently, has just completed an Open University law degree. He plans to go on and complete it, but he's been involved in the music industry and in the rights contracts world as well. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Well, we had today a very important report delivered at 1:30 by Sir Brian Leveson, Lord Justice Leveson, who said that the press had wreaked havoc in the lives of innocent people for many decades. And he said the proposals in his report will protect the rights of victims and people bringing complaints. What we'd like to do first, David, if we may, is go to the pre-Leveson position and the law relating to control of the press, if any.
Well, in one way, the press has long been regulated, if you take regulation to mean there are rules in place, the breach of which will lead to certain sanctions.
Yeah.
There is the common law, the law of libel, the statutory law of contempt of court, data protection law, a whole range of statutory provisions which newspapers have to comply with. If you look at the Bible of the law of journalism, McNay's edition of Law for Journalists, you will see there are 85 or so statutes listed as being somehow relevant to the practical work of a journalist. So, in a way, journalism, just like any other activity, has been regulated by some kind of law. More recently, there has been an attempt to have what is essentially a form of self-regulation under the so-called Press Complaints Commission. A lot of people misunderstood the role of a Press Complaints Commission, but the key to what it actually did is in its name. It was not expressly a regulator. It was there for dealing with complaints against the press, which is a slightly different thing. It's more of an ombudsman's role than as a regulator. And in some ways, it did it quite well, especially pre-publication. If there was a question of something being published, they often could get in there and stop things being published, which obviously shouldn't have been published. But it was not a regulator and should never have been regarded as such. And on things like phone hacking, it spectacularly failed. So this was the sort of regime we were at the start of the Leveson Inquiry. There was common law, there was statute, there was the Press Complaints Commission. But there was a real sense that, taken together, these various provisions just were not working.
Well, that's a pretty clear summary of the position before. But Leveson stressed today that the press had failed to properly regulate itself in the past, and he believed that the law could be used to validate a new body. But he did make it very clear that he wasn't introducing any concept of statutory regulation as such. It was really a validation of a new form of self-regulation backed up by statute. Carl, what are your thoughts on today?
Well, I think it's really interesting what he's proposed. I mean, I have written on my blog in favour of statutory regulation, by which I meant not obviously the sort of state control by politicians that some scaremonger, as I would call them in the press, have been frightening people about in recent days, but a proper regulator established by statute who would have proper powers to regulate and discipline the press. Now, that's not quite what Leveson is offering his recommendations. That's a little bit short of what I expected, but he has come up with something ingenious, I think. I've heard that word used, and I think that's right. It's not very dissimilar from, I think, the Irish model of regulation. It's not very dissimilar from the way advertising is regulated, but it is, in a way, unique, because what he says is this. statute should not set up a regulator or establish it, or really say anything about it, except what principles, what conditions a regulator must satisfy. What he wants a statute in order to do is create a recognition body, a kind of validation authority, yes, if you like, that will look at any regulator that comes to it. And he contemplates that there may be more than one, even, that the press comes up with. He would prefer there just to be one. And it will validate it. It will say whether or not this regulator meets his principles. And if it does, it will be formally recognised. And subscribers to it will then have certain benefits. Mm.
But he did make it very clear, didn't he, that what he was proposing was not that the board would be telling the press how to do things or not to do things, but would be holding them accountable when they broke the principles. Is that right?
Underpinning was the word, yes, that he used.
Yeah.
Well, the question is, and it's perhaps a semantic question, but I think it is important to be clear. Is this statutory regulation or not? On one hand, you have the contention that it isn't statutory regulation because the actual rules which will be posited and hopefully abided by will not be statutory rules. They will be rules put together by an independent body which the press should or should not follow, and enforcement of those rules will be, again, part of what this independent body does. In that way, it isn't a statutory regulation because the regulations themselves are not statutory provisions.
Yes.
But, and this is where I'm not terribly convinced by some of the contentions, it's a form of regulation which is possible on the proposal of the Leveson Inquiry, only possible with statute. Take the statute away, take the statutory underpinning away, then it seems to me that what we have again is a sort of sense of self-regulation, regulation by consent, which in many circumstances is not regulation at all. So is it the statutory regulation or not? Well, in a way it isn't, but we are also looking at something which is only possible if certain statutory provisions are put in place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in his executive summary, Leveson actually, paragraph one, right at the beginning, says, establishing an independent self-regulatory regime, and I quote paragraph one, an independent self-regulatory body should be governed by an independent board. In order to ensure the independence of the body, the chair and members of the board must be appointed in a genuinely open, transparent and independent way without any influence from industry or government.
Mm-hmm.
Now that is pretty clear statement. He also indicated, did he not, that there'd be no compulsion to join this body, but there would be incentives to make it attractive so to do, which we'll come on to later in terms of penalties, which are very interesting.
And very cleverly done.
It was cleverly done, because at one stroke it removes any possible criticism that the government is in some respects trying to limit free speech in the United Kingdom, because that is not the case. That is not the intention behind Leveson.
In fact, to some extent, he sold it on the notion of enshrinement of the freedom of the press.
Yes, although one can be very sceptical of having these statutory provisions.
Well, it's the first time in 300 years, or 400 years, perhaps first time ever to have a statutory underpinning there.
Yeah, but this sort of statutory assertion that the role of government is to protect the freedom of the press. I remember some of the proposals under NHS legislation where what some people would say would be a detrimental attack on the NHS was accompanied by, oh, for the first time ever, there will be a duty on the government to promote the NHS as a statutory duty. And so that for me seemed a little bit of window dressing. It'd be very difficult to see what legal difference such a grand declaration in the statutory provision would have. What is more interesting are the other things he intended to do by statute.
Carl, can you take us a little bit more deeply into this?
Yeah, well, first, I agree very much with what David just said about the sort of airy, legal, as it were, duty to promote the freedom of expression. In terms of the regulator and sanctions and so on, as you say, Mike, this is going to be a voluntary system which is a particularly interesting aspect of what Leveson's going to come up with.
Yes.
He's not proposing that anyone be forced to be part of it. He's proposing that the press have to create their own regulator.
Yeah, but there's a very big sanction here.
Well, or if they can't create one, to come up with more than one. And that subscription should be voluntary. Where the tough aspect comes in is this, that what he wants to do is incentivise subscription to a regulator by making life a lot easier for those who subscribe and more difficult for those who don't. For those who do, he wants the regulators to offer a complaint service free to people. He wants them to offer arbitration services in civil proceedings. Now, this is particularly interesting, I think, because what he's saying is people should be able to come to the regulator with libel claims
yes.
and privacy claims yeah. instead of the courts.
Which would cut the costs significantly.
Cut the cost radically.
Radically, yeah.
It would also make it extremely accessible to ordinary people,
yeah.
Almost certainly. Now, I wrote yesterday about the connection between regulation of the press and reform of libel and privacy. I'm very pleased to see that he's made that connection. So there will be that advantage. People who, if you are a subscriber, if you're a newspaper who subscribes, and someone under Leveson's proposal sues you for libel in the courts anyway, he's proposing that person be at great risk as to costs. They might not even get the costs even if they win, because they should have gone through arbitration. Yeah. So benefits to subscribers. On the other hand, perhaps problems for non-subscribers. Anybody who didn't subscribe would face the chill winds of normal libel potentially cost and exemplary damages penalties if people did win in libel or privacy cases against
them. And that's quite a big stick lurking in the background and very much an incentive. But the beautiful elegance of his proposal, of course, is that it's a free service.
Yeah.
And presumably no specific legal representation is needed, but it would be advised, as in any circumstance, but it's unlikely that the tribunal, or however it's constituted, would want to see complex legal structures in place. David, you're a practicing solicitor. What's your view on that?
Well, decreasing the costs of libel and privacy litigation works both ways. At the moment, the sheer cost of potential privacy or libel proceedings acts indirectly as a check.
Yeah.
One false move, one defamatory publication, or one invasion of privacy which cannot be justified, then you end up with a very heavy legal bill. That in itself has a certain outcome which you can call regulation. If you decrease the cost and the costs risk for the newspapers of getting it wrong on libel and privacy, then it becomes less of a check to them. So decreasing the costs of content-based litigation, as you would call it, in itself does not necessarily mean we will get a better, more healthy, more honest press. It may well be that you're decreasing the costs and making it commercially more attractive for them to get it wrong.
A freer press, in other words. And this is one of the arguments I've used in favour of this sort of thing, that reduce the cost of libel. I think the biggest chilling factor on free speech has been the financial risk of libel and privacy actions on the media. If we can get rid of that, then they'll be able to take more risks, actually. Be able to take more risks and be less self-censoring.
And get it wrong more often.
Well,
which is not the output any of us want.
Well, perhaps, David, but I'll just make the point because I think it's an important counter to the suggestion that all these new systems will be shackling the press, the reverse.
The new body, the independent tribunal, so to speak, will have very significant powers if the newspapers will step out of line and lose, basically, before this tribunal. The fines could be very significant. The damages could be very significant.
Up to £1 million.
Up to £1 million.
Yes, but if you just look at recent contempt of court enforcement, the threat of a fine in itself does not really deter bad journalistic practice.
But there were never 30,000, 40,000 recent fines, weren't they? 15,000 and 40,000, I seem to remember, which presumably for a big newspaper is It's not small change, but it's not exactly a significant sum of money.
Yeah, but I was particularly interested in some of the other powers that the regulator will have to have. To be able to accept complaints from anyone, I think, is important. Mm-hmm. Third parties, interest groups, and so on. To investigate matters of its own motion. And in terms of apologies and corrections, not just the power to order them, but the power to direct the nature and extent of apologies. And I think that's a very important sanction.
Anything else on the complaint side? Because Leveson did stress, and I want to bring this out, paragraph 17 of the executive summary, this new board should not have the power to prevent publication of any material by anyone at any time, although in its discretion it should be able to offer a service of advice to editors of subscribing publications relating to code compliance, which editors in their discretion can deploy in civil proceedings arising out of publication.
Yeah, I think this is particularly interesting. He's set his face against prior restraint, which, you know, someone like me probably would argue some prior restraint is required in the system, some possible recourse to it, but he's set his face against it. Fair enough. I think most people interested in the freedom of the press have great problems with the idea. But this advice system is possibly another ingenious invention of his. He says he would like it possibly to be, you said, they're deployed in civil proceedings. In other words, a little bit like a mechanism I'm familiar with in European law, where the European Commission's advice to governments will influence how their behaviour is regarded in the European Court of Justice. If an editor chooses to phone up the regulator and say, you know, we've got a story here about someone like Max Mosley, for instance, what do you think of this in privacy terms? If they get advice saying that there was a public interest and it was legitimate from the regulator, that would to some extent shield them in proceedings later. Or the contrary would be the case. Bad advice would expose them to further risk. Mm. That it's very interesting. I think when the press, when the detail settles in, this may be one of the things that concerns editors most, actually, in the proposals. But I think it's a good proposal.
Where do you want to take it now, David, in terms of the analysis? Can we perhaps mention the response, although we're doing a legal analysis, it is quite important to set it in its context of the government response this afternoon. And I find it rather curious, Prime Minister.
I think it would be useful, perhaps, as we're approaching this from a legal perspective, to take one step back and actually look at the Leveson inquiry as an inquiry to see, so we can understand exactly what its job was. Because there is a judge involved, or because there were barristers involved, and some very high quality work by the barristers, and or because in some respects a judicial process was involved, it was actually quite different from what most lawyers would understand as a legal process. It certainly wasn't an adjudication. It wasn't a court case. It wasn't a trial or an appeal, which is what lawyers usually do. It was a public inquiry under the Public Inquiries Act. And so although it had the trappings and some of the features of a judicial process, it wasn't. Not overall. It was a fact-finding exercise. And in that way, I think the real merit of the Leveson inquiry, and I've maintained this for some time, may well be in the process rather than in the outcome. Mm. Because a whole range of information, witness evidence, documents, was safely placed into the public domain, which otherwise would not have been placed into the public domain, but for the Leveson inquiry. And now, if you go into the Leveson inquiry website, there's PDF after PDF, dozens, hundreds of them, setting out evidence which is available to all of us so we can actually see what certain newspapers, politicians, and other people were doing.
It's all been put up there, hasn't it?
It's all been up there. And if we look at the detail of the Leveson inquiry and chase things through their footnotes, it's open for any of us to double check whether the conclusions and contentions have a decent evidence base. We don't have to be told what to think. And so in that way, it's more of an academic exercise. It's a report with footnotes, and we can actually go straight to the footnotes.
An element of catharsis as well.
Absolutely. Certainly not on the scale of the truth and reconciliation exercise in South Africa, but very much everybody under the protection of privilege was able to get things off their chest who were concerned with press abuses. And there were people who otherwise wouldn't have had a voice were able to say, this was wrong, this shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
And so, as an inquiry, I think, even regardless of the recommendations in the report, it was a great achievement. I think it was well conducted. I think everybody felt as if they had the opportunity to say what they wanted to say, and it was easy for other people to follow. But all that means is that a very good report may or may not have been published. It certainly doesn't mean any determinations of guilt or legal liability of anybody. Nobody is now culpable just because of the Leveson report. That's not what it was intended for. It was an inquiry, not a judicial trial.
It pointed a few moral fingers at activity, though. And in that respect, it's performed another valuable task.
Oh, absolutely. The things which have uncovered are going to be fascinating for historians and commentators for some time to come. But it was not a replacement for the trials and charges which are currently going through on hacking and various other things. And so even if these recommendations don't gain any traction, I don't think that by itself will discredit or undermine the significance of the Leveson inquiry. It may be great if something good comes out of the recommendations, but I think something good has already been achieved.
Carl.
Yeah, I agree. I think it shows the importance not only of the internet in spreading information, making it accessible. We saw that with the Hillsborough inquiry, and we've seen it again with
Absolutely.
This one. Also shows the importance of televising these things. You know, the fact that it was visible on the internet to people, and quite a lot of it on live TV on the normal channels, was important, I think. And I won't say any more about it, but I think it's a bit of a lesson for televising of the courts. I think talking about the outcome, the one thing we've not mentioned so far in connection with the regulator and the sort of self-regulation with statutory underpinning that Lord Justice Leveson has recommended is the problem of non-subscribers. This week we had a leader in the Spectator.
Yes, Fraser Nelson.
Mm. Fraser Nelson has basically said, if there's any form of statutory regulation, the Spectator would not take part in it, not pay its fines, not go to meetings, etc. Now,
good prison.
Bless.
I think he was saying no. I mean, I think. I think. I mean, the leader said, I think we would obey the other laws of the land, which I thought was an extremely sort of arrogant, chillingly arrogant thing to say. Actually, an editor publicly taking the stand that he would disobey the law, sort of whatever was suggested. But interestingly, Leveson has dealt with the Spectator problem to some extent, because first of all, it is a voluntary system. Yeah. So Fraser Nelson will not have to subscribe to anything like this. And Leveson hasn't said that everyone would have to be part of it.
Yes.
There might be parties in civil courts.
The point that was made on Daily Politics the day before Leveson's report was published was that Andrew Neil was saying, so, you know, any form of state regulation is effectively licensed. You've got to have a license to publish. And, of course, that's not the case.
That's not the case.
Not the case.
What it is, and again, when the detail sinks in of Leveson, I think this will be one of the controversial elements, Leveson does raise the prospect. He doesn't recommend, but he raises the prospects of Parliament. He says you've got to think about what to do about non-subscribers beyond the costs, penalties in libel, etc. that I've suggested. And he proposes or suggests the existence or creation of a backstop regulator, and possibly Ofcom being a backstop regulator, as it were, to clear up the few non-subscribers. And that was essentially the kind of proper statutory regulation I wanted in the first place.
Well, before we get on to reaction, let's look at that. We're talking about mainstream press, which some say is on the way out as a medium of information, and it'll probably all go online fairly soon. But what about smaller publications, the regional newspapers? Take it down a step to smaller magazines. Take it down even further a step. I saw a tweet today where the editor, I think it was, Helen Lewis of the New Statesman, was
Deputy editor,
I'm sorry, calling Guido Fawkes out, saying that she had twice the number of subscribers to or visitors to the blog last week, which I thought was wonderful. But they're putting it 250,000 there, which is a lot of visitors. It's quite influential in that sense. What about bloggers? Are they going to be dealt with within this code?
Well, it's quite unclear. I've read the section on bloggers in the Leveson Inquiry, and I'm, to be frank, not that much of a riser where Leveson, Lord Justice Leveson, sees how blogging hits it. On one hand, he sees bloggers as a valuable service, and on Night Jack, he's very kind about the work I did on putting together the analysis. But on the other hand, he's not terribly over-impressed by Guido Fawkes' blog, if you read that section. And tweeting, you could almost fit what he says about Twitter in a few number of tweets. Yes. He doesn't actually say a great deal about it. And this is where I have an issue, because although I am not over-impressed by some of the alarmism of the newspaper industry, there was a real task for Lord Justice Leveson. Take, for example, I have put together a piece of journalism and I offer it to the New Statesman. And mm-hmm. Helen Lewis says, we can't publish that on the internet or in the print edition because that would put us in breach of our obligations under the PCC or whatever Leveson regulator comes to be named as. And I go, I can't publish it on New Statesman. That's a pity. I'll publish it on Jack of Kent instead, which isn't a regulated blog. It may get as many hits. I would tweet and the link in the same way I would do with any of the work I do. And the stuff would be out there, be published, it would be read, it'd probably be read by about the same number of people and also be followed up by the same number of people if it's of any interest to anybody. What will the regulation have achieved? Well, it may well have stopped a commercial publisher publishing something, but it hasn't actually stopped it being published.
I think the point about Leveson's, really, one of the points, many points, was that the big commercial publishers have abused their power. It's very clear that most bloggers do not abuse their audience, and even if they do, it's a very small audience, and it's easily rectified by the normal processes of law. You can sue someone in libel, and you can take them to court for breach of privacy. Guido Fawkes maintains, and in fact it was quite interesting reading the report on this section, that you know he can get round it because he bungs all this stuff off to America. So he's not governed by British law.
Well, maybe. He may have to take that risk. I mean, I've just looked at the recommendations on the regulator really in any detail, not any passages specifically on blogging, but it's fairly clear to me from what Lord Justice Leveson says about regulation, that he envisages the regulator would be open to bloggers to join, yeah. At least if the regulator permitted them to, might be up to them. I have to, my immediate reaction, writing a blog which, you know, is non-commercial at the moment anyway, is that if there was a regulator set up by the press and it was open to my blog and it was free, you know, proportionate to the income of my blog small, I would want to join it.
But you may as well.
I would want to join it. I think this is a really good innovation that will help bloggers, and certainly the choice that is going to be offered to bloggers between joining this new world of high standards or remaining in the wider internet is really interesting.
But you may as well regulate pamphleteers as regulate bloggers.
But it doesn't regulate them. It gives them a chance to opt into self-regulation themselves.
It's unlikely that anything for the average blogger in the new code will be controversial. It'll be behaviour that they would indulge in quite naturally. I sometimes wonder, the cynic in me, that you know the big newspapers have got the budgets to take risks and they've got the chill factor of deep legal pockets and say, all right, bring it on, we're still publishing. Publish and be damned. But no blogger would do that, so we're less likely to be, we haven't got the money for a start, we're less likely to be taking that sort of abusive risk.
And often when bloggers and tweeters have fallen foul of taking these sort of risks, it's because of things which have spread from the mainstream media onto Twitter rather than actually something which has been brought to social media by tweeters and bloggers. Like, for example, the super injunctions thing a couple of years ago, I still maintain that the list which was leaked could only have come from a newspaper office. There was no other person who would have had a list of all the privacy injunctions which were then in force.
But I would want to join because it would be protection. We have seen bloggers sued for libel. Some people will threaten that sort of thing quite freely. I would welcome the protection of the kind of free systems and arbitration that Leveson is offering. I think it would make me freer.
Yes, I think you're right. I can see the logic there. So can we, before we go into any further sections of the Leveson report, get a rough idea on the temperature of the reception? We've already seen that Fraser Nelson wouldn't sign up to it. I don't know if he's changed his tune, actually, having read the Leveson report. Perhaps he should have waited before he went off on his pronouncements. But what about the others? What's the reception been this afternoon? We know that the Prime Minister's not that enthusiastic about enacting a statute. He's quite keen on the principles. We know that Ed Miliband is very keen on bringing the whole of Leveson into play and will try to persuade the Prime Minister, and I haven't heard what Mr Clegg said.
Mr Clegg was not essentially opposed to it. You know, he said that as a Liberal, it wasn't for him to generally want to regulate or restrict the freedom of the press and so forth, but he didn't think that this particularly sought to do that, and on that basis he didn't have a huge thing against it.
So this is not a coalition busting bust up between the two men?
I don't think it's that big, big a deal. You know.
Carl?
Well, I think constitutionally it was absolutely fascinating in the House of Parliament, in the House of Commons this afternoon, because the Prime Minister got up to make a statement. And there was the normal reply from the Leader of the Opposition in question. Then the Deputy Prime Minister came up to make his own statement, and the same routine was gone through. And Peter Bone, I think it was, a Conservative backbencher, asked a question to Nick Clegg, do you speak for the government? Obviously the answer to that was no, but the Prime Minister can't have been speaking for the government either.
Yeah, but it's not
the Deputy Prime Minister. I'm not saying there's a problem with it, David.
It's not a novelty.
What I'm saying is it's absolutely fascinating that we had statements from ministers, neither of whom was speaking for the government, which appears to have no policy on this matter.
That's the important thing, is that you can only have collective responsibility of cabinet when there is a government policy. There are historically examples of, for example, the referendum on membership of the then EEC in 1975, where different ministers were able publicly to take different views. It's rare, but it's not that exceptional.
I don't think they made statements from the dispatch box, though, as ministers.
But Nick Clegg did say that the Leveson report or inquiry was initiated by the coalition in agreement, and therefore he felt it necessary for both of them to make a statement as to the outcome of the entire thing.
So all was pre-Leveson report publication speculation was all for naught, really.
Yes, and some of it was quite alarmist.
Yes, it
was like chicken licking. Everybody, certain journalists thought the sky was about to fall in at 1:30 today. And
Is it still there?
It is, actually. I looked up and, you know, the sky was clear. I think very few people, certainly nobody around this table, has had the opportunity to digest the entire report yet. It's, you know, four hefty volumes, which amusingly cannot be sold separately, like so many Coke cans in a supermarket. But the
different supplements of a newspaper.
Absolutely, yes. There's a lot in there which, at this stage of the recording, nobody actually knows. And as somebody once said about the French Revolution, you know, what is its significance? And somebody said it's too early to tell. I think the real effect of Leveson will be when people go through the recommendations, look at the underlying evidence, and then see the next outrage. What concerns me a little bit is, like the generals of the First World War were too busy fighting the battles of the Boer War, some of the abuses which Leveson looked at over the last 10, 15 years are no longer current in what is called Fleet Street. for buying of unlawful information from private detectives is a practice which has effectively come to an end and has not really been prevalent for about 2 or 3 years, even at the worst newspapers for it. Insofar as Leveson is addressing the practices of the press in the first decade of his century, what relevance is that now? It's not absolutely clear. It's a solution to a problem which has already gone away.
The rest of the report, at least in terms of the summary, executive summary, goes on to talk about relations between the police and the press, and the press and politicians. Have you got any comments you'd like to make on either of those two issues?
Well, just on the second one, really, Mike, which is that Leveson does deal with the relationship between Jeremy Hunt, when he was Culture, Media and Sport, Secretary of State, and News Corp over the Sky bid, the B-Sky B merger deal, you remember, and his intervention in the public interest when he questioned this on the grounds of media plurality. I think Leveson is fairly soft on him, really. There is some criticism, says that obviously the special advisor's position was wrong, shouldn't have been given the role that he was, and he says that this gave rise at least to a perception of bias. That has to be right. I've written that it is unlawful, and it seems to me that Leveson has basically agreed with that without using the word.
He's basically made the point of actually discounting bias, even though there was an air of it, which I think is quite important in some senses, that he's taken the opportunity to deny some of the aspersions that were cast around in some senses. You know,
of actual bias,
actual
bias. Yeah. But he does say there was a perception of bias. I was quite depressed that he used the word quasi-judicial to describe what Jeremy Hunt was doing. I've got a campaign against that phrase. But that's a one interesting aspect of the report.
David.
There's always going to be real politique. Politicians, ministers, both have power and want power. Proprietors and editors want to be able to influence politicians. That's always going to happen. To try and somehow artificially stop that happening is to be, I think, fairly naive. The Leveson inquiry heard from a number of former ministers and prime ministers, spoke to a number of proprietors and editors. And I don't think it could come to a satisfactory resolution. The press and the political class will constantly try and influence each other. What I think Leveson hasn't really looked at and should have done is things about concentration of the press, because what really matters about the influence politicians and the press have on each other is when the press, certain press barons have disproportionate power.
I think you made a very good point earlier, David, that we've only really had time to digest the executive summary. And having been rather cynical about some people rushing off before the report came out to actually prejudge it, I think you're right, a lot will come out over the next 2 or 3 weeks.
But well, I was in the press room before the actual report came out, and it was all the great and the good of political and media journalism and legal journalism were in this conference suite room, not allowed to actually communicate anything in a way which would publish it to the outside world, desperately trying to get through the executive summary and the four thick volumes in the half hour available.
Speed reading, I think Joshua called it.
Yes, and fortunately I happened to sit next to Joshua Rosenberg, who gave me a sort of idiot's guide to what he'd already mastered about it and was typically spot on, as he usually is. Had very quickly I saw this long stop role for Ofcom as being very interesting. But it's going to take, as I said, it's going to take not just today, it may take some time. But the one thing Lord Justice Leveson was quite anxious not to happen, and he said this in fairly colourful terms, is that he didn't want this to be something which was just on the shelves of media professors.
Yeah.
And I think it's not going to be, for the simple reason that the underlying evidence, the for witness evidence, for documents, are all on the web and we can take our time and go through it for ourselves. We don't actually have to go to the public record office in Kew.
Well, I hope David's right, but I fear that he may not be. This business about reports gathering dust on shelves, it is very much a worry in this area. The Calcutt report in 1919, review of press self-regulation in 1993, I wrote about on my blog the other day. And in that review, when he reviewed the first 2 years of the operation of the Press Complaints Commission and basically said it was no good, dominated by the industry and completely favouring the industry. And he said then that statutory regulation of the press was needed. Ministers, for some reason, the government didn't actually bring that in. That was the last chance saloon that never closed.
Politicians that are in the last saloon now.
Well, I was astonished actually by the Prime Minister's reaction in the House of Commons today. He's said that he would implement this report if it wasn't bonkers. It's no one could call it bonkers. Yet, in his statement, he was all misgivings and all concern, wants cross-party talks. Now, if he doesn't want a statute, it's difficult to see what those cross-party talks can be about.
Well, perhaps he's trying to say that he has got concerns and these need to be looked at very carefully. It's the language of kicking the stuff into the long grass.
It's exactly that. It's the language of kicking.
Nick Clegg did actually finish his speech by saying he looked forward to these cross-party talks at the earliest convenience, and he was very keen that the momentum of what
we've had 18 months of it
would be completed.
We've had 18 months of it, of inquiry, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
We've had years of abusive behaviour. There's really no reason not to implement some of the things voluntarily now in terms of behaviour and get this thing moving quickly.
Yeah, but as you said earlier, Mike, just a minute, as you said earlier, the statutory underpinning is essential to these recommendations.
Yes, I think it is.
But something Sir Brian Leveson said today I think was absolutely spot on. There would be no need to a large extent for any regulation if the press policed itself and held itself to account in the same way it routinely holds politicians, businesses, sportsmen and women to account. With the exceptions of things like The Guardian and some journalists on other broadsheets at The Independent and also Private Eye, there is a general reluctance in what is called Fleet Street for newspapers to expose the failings of other newspapers, even their own competitors.
It's dog eat dog, isn't it?
Dog doesn't eat dog. As Nick Davies points out in his excellent book, Flat Earth News, if newspapers investigated each other, held other journalists to account, then they would by themselves be doing the work, which you would normally call self-regulation, self-policing. But that, for some reason, has never, ever taken off in this country, and there's no real reason to believe it does so.
That's right. That's the problem. Everybody says that would be the solution. I wish that was the solution. We all wish that would be the solution in the Last Chance Saloon when the Press Complaints Commission was set up, but it wasn't. We've seen this week that many in the press have a kind of deep-seated ideological objection and resistance to the whole idea of proper regulation. And I think it's extraordinary that they go along even with self-regulation, actually, except as a fig leaf. And I think any delay of the Prime Minister, any shilly-shallying now, all it does is create room for there to be yet another total failure to address this issue.
Yes. Well, I think it's just by way of rounding it off for the evening, worth having a look at the words Leveson used. The press has to be accountable to the public in whose interests it claims to be acting and must show respect for the rights of others. It should not be acceptable that it uses its voice, power and authority to undermine the ability of society to require that regulation is not a free-for-all to be ignored with impunity. And I think he ended it with these words, didn't he? The answer to the question, who guards the guardians, should not be no one. Which I thought was rather lovely.
And at the Queen Elizabeth Conference Centre today, which where the report was published, Lord Justice Leveson was quite emphatic that he's now done his job.
Yes.
He is no longer going to be interested in dealing with questions. He might be summoned to Parliament, and actually, in principle, there's no reason why, given it's not a trial or an appeal, but an inquiry, he couldn't answer questions, as long as he's perfectly sensible in how, you know, what questions he answers and not. But there's a real sense that he has now done for this job. And he walked out with the legal team, his legal team of barristers, his administrators, all walking behind him. And you got a sense of they think their work has done. And there is this wartime cartoon of this man who survived an attack on the boat. And he says, his peace, you know, don't lose it again. You know, this is something, this is an opportunity for the press to save itself.
Yep.
I'm giving it to you. And then, almost in a puff of smoke, the Leveson team disappeared and has just left us with four volumes of their report.
Yes. And finally, Carl.
Yeah, I just one of the details that came out of my reading of the report, that, you know, those who are interested in things legal and to do with civil liberties will be interested in, once or twice in his recommendations about a regulation scheme, Lord Justice Leveson gives footnotes about advice that he got from various of his, I think they called assessors,
yes,
one of whom was Shani Chakrabarty. And interesting, I've not looked at them all in detail, but it's interesting to see her advice at one or two points was differ from his recommendations. And listeners might be interested to see, I mean, my impression of the notes of her advice is that she took quite a traditional kind of free speech-based approach. For instance, saying I think she thought that a court should be the recognition body validating the regulator. And so on. I'll want to look in more detail at the advice that she gave, but I think that's a point of interest.
Yes. Well, we can come back and in future and look at these things in more detail, but
the more sector-specific the regulation, the more fiddly and complicated the arrangements with bodies here and validation there, the more things which can go wrong. I'm sceptical of regulation. Most regulations don't have the consequences which are envisaged by the people who put forward the regulations. My view, and I think it's a practical view, is that as much as possible should be just left to the law of the land. Especially now that we are war publishers, there is nothing now stopping anybody with an internet connection publishing to the world.
It's about law enforcement. I mean, Leveson covered that point
I'm a little less enamoured with regulation than Cole, and I would have liked, if we're not going to actually have a proper regulatory system underpinned by statute with statutory powers, then as much as possible should be done to improve the law of the land which comes to people who happen to publish materials, whether they are commercial publishers or not.
Right. Yeah, I love regulation, as David often accuses me, so I would be very, very keen of it. A bit sceptical of the arguments about the law of the land people have been using this week. I had an interesting debate about that with Ken and Malik on Twitter today. But some of the people this week who've been saying, you know, the answer is for the law of the land to be enforced.
We could have enforced the criminal law a bit more with the police activity.
Of course, but I think people using this argument against regulation should be make it clear whether they're saying there should be no change and just, you know, the police enforce or not. Press behaviour can't be a police priority. Or whether they're saying police enforcement should be beefed up. Now that would be the ultimate state regulation, because it would mean that the police had to watch or look at and think about what the press was doing more. I think that's one of the worst arguments that's been used this week, actually, against regulation.
But we are in a situation which was not there 15, 20 years ago. 15, 20 years ago, it was actually quite difficult to publish or broadcast to the world, unless you were a pamphleteer or started a pirate radio station. Now we're in a situation where, in principle, anybody can publish or broadcast to the world. And if that's the case, what sense does it make that a small minority of those people, because they're somehow commercially engaged in what they're doing, are under different legal obligations to the rest of us who can still publish and broadcast? It's a more difficult question, And this is why I'm concerned about Leveson ultimately answering the questions which were posed by what was happening 5, 10, 15 years ago rather than what's happening now.
I think he's come to a brilliant pragmatic solution to it, actually. He's not answered abstract questions about the boundary between online and print or what all bloggers would do. He's not attempted to regulate bloggers. But he has given us this possible way ahead into a kind
well,
of
I'm more,
under the skirt
I'm
of protective
with,
regulation.
I think I'm more with David on this. I quite like the law of the land. I think on that note, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you,
and
Mike.
I hope people enjoyed listening to that. Thank you very much indeed also for your advice on the sound, Jez.
Cheerio.
Bye.